Thanks very much for that overkind introduction. Could we have the house lights down for the, because I'm going to go through slides. It's always slightly worrying to be reminded what one said one is going to talk about in a talk a couple of months after one's actually written it. But I'm largely going to talk about that. In fact, what I'm going to do is I'm going to divide the talk into three parts. And the first is describing some of the challenges ahead in the global food system. I'm then going to segue into some of the work we do in Oxford here to try and understand some of the challenges ahead. And then finally go on to some of the issues around globalization and stress testing. And again, as everyone knows, if you're hungry, then that is politically causes huge problems, and so lack of food is one of the main drivers of conflicts. And my talk, I think, will set the scene for Brian Lander, who'll be speaking after me from the World Food Programme, who's going to talk about some of the real issues where this issues around food actually have led to real conflicts and what the World Food Programme is doing. Now, as you heard, my background is as a population biologist, and the founder of our field, and also one of the three classic founders of the field of economics is Thomas Malthus. And Thomas Malthus was the first person to really conceptualize in a way that I suspect every ruler had known since rulers existed about the importance of being able to feed a population in order to have a stable polity. And Malthus's famous argument in his 1798 essay on the principle of population, a pessimistic argument at a time of rather positive views about progress, was that populations, human populations, actually other populations, increased geometrically, 2, 4, 8, 16, whereas our ability to feed them increases arithmetically, is limited by land, 2, 4, 6, 8. And Malthus wrote very pessimistically at the end of the 18th century, predicting famines, warfare in Europe in the early part of the 19th century. And this didn't happen. It didn't happen for really interesting, fascinating reasons associated with the Industrial Revolution and both the technological advances associated with the Industrial Revolution, but also the economic advances as well. So I like to think of that as a sort of first of three waves of Malthusian pessimism about the ability of humanity to feed its population and the effect this may have on peace and civil stability. And I guess, well, I don't guess, I know, I'm afraid to say, I'm old enough to remember what I think is the second wave. And this was a wave during the 1970s associated with authors such as Paul Ehrlich, like me, an entomologist, who wrote The Population Bomb. I remember reading it when I was 18. It's one of the most extraordinary books I've ever read and sort of changing the way I thought about things. I was asked by Radio 3 to do one of their 15-minute essays on the book that really had changed my mind, changed the way I thought about things a couple of years back. And I reread The Population Bomb through 2017 eyes. I was shocked. This is sort of advocating coercive population control and things. And you can see why he argued for it at the time, although again with modern sensibilities, it's a pretty shocking book. And the reason why Ehrlich and the Club of Rome and other predictions didn't come apart, they were predicting the breakup of democracy in Europe in the early parts of the 21st century because of problems with feeding. And the reason that didn't come about was because of the Green Revolution. The fantastic increase in our ability to produce crops during the 1970s and 80s. And excuse me. And if you look at, if we mark everything in 1960 as one, and you look at the way population has increased, the blue line there, you can see that the amount of land we've brought into agriculture in the last, you probably can't see it, but that graph begins in 1960, over the last 50 years or so, crop area has expanded very little, and yet crop production has more than kept pace with the rise of population. So at the moment, the issues around food, and Brian, I'm sure we'll talk more about this later, It's not our ability to feed the population, at least at the moment. Our ability about food is far more about access and affordability. Now, of course, and this is in parentheses and something I won't sort of develop much more here, one of the reasons the Green Revolution worked is we had new germplasm, new crops that were able to be highly productive, but they needed many more inputs. And I've plotted the black line there, fertilizer use, and the talks before the break about climate change. Well, agriculture is a really major contributor to greenhouse gases, and fertilizer use to make fertilizers, Haber-Bosch, is hugely energy expensive. So what about the third wave? Well, the third wave, I would argue, was really recently, around about 2008-2010. Actually, I think that food and the ability of governments to feed the population had largely fallen off major political agendas, not for the least developed countries, but certainly in developed and even middle-income countries. I think that people were not thinking a lot about food. And that changed around about 2008 when one got a hike in food prices. And that is the FAO Food Price Index. Again, it's a bit faint at the bottom. That starts at 1990. Just a technical point, I give two figures there. The red is nominal, the blue is deflated. But the way you do it is you use United States, American inflation figures to get that. And it's unclear, for an economist, you would point out that it's unclear that that's the right way to change nominal into the reality experienced by people, especially in developing countries. So the reality is going to be somewhere between those two numbers. But you'll see in 2008, and then followed a few years later in 2010, a significant increases in food prices, which have dropped back since then. That data now is relatively up to date. I last updated it in March. But it was a wake-up call that we do need to think about food production. I would point out, and this is the figure in the lower left, which is US corn prices. And I use that because there are really good statistics going back to the beginning of the century. If you look at volatility in corn prices, which is a good proxy for general food prices, you see the 2008 blip was tiny compared with the oil crisis of the 70s and World War I and World War II. But it's an element of how used we had become to fairly stable food prices, plus the connectedness of the world, that those relatively modest food price hikes in 2008 had such political ramifications. I'm going to come back to that again right at the end. So that was the third wave, what I'd argue, of Malthusian pessimism. And is there an underlying cause to worry about a Malthusian hard landing? Let me first of all give you the good news, and this is going back to my background as a population biologist. And I genuinely, when I lecture the undergraduates, I genuinely say that I'm 60 this year and that I am more optimistic now than when I was sitting in the audience at their age. And the reason for that is the world is going through a demographic transition. So populations are naturally, fecundity is naturally reducing. If we bring people out of poverty, if we provide access to reproductive health care, if we educate their kids, especially their girls, then population numbers do go down. So the pessimism I had when I was in my teens and 20s reading Paul Ehrlich, I'm much more cheerful now because of the reality of population, of the demographic transition. Now I look at the kids and they look pretty happy at this, and then I say, well, actually I'm a little bit more pessimistic age 60 than when I was 55, because I think there's some worrying things happening. The demographic transition is not happening as fast in Africa as we expected and we hoped. I'm happy to talk about that. So that's good news, but there is some bad news as well. And it's both good and bad news. Now, one of the reasons why fecundity is going down is that people are coming out of poverty, which is just a good thing. People who come out of poverty want a more varied diet. Now, one of the issues is that a more varied diet, especially a diet that includes meat, has a far greater impact on the environment. And the figure there shows patterns of meat consumption. In Europe, I don't know if I have a you can read it as well. I mean, in Europe, meat consumption is fairly, has plateaued and is probably about to go down. In China, it's going up. The inset graph is what we are expecting globally going into the future. That's up to 2050. As one of the previous speakers said before the break, we cannot go on continuing to eat meat to the degree we have done in the past, for both climate change reasons, but also for just producing enough food. So the hard decisions that will be need to be taken in the future are on the consumption side. So on the demand side, there's both good and bad news. The good news is that population growth is decelerating. The more concerning news is that per capita consumption of the types of food that have the greatest impact on the environment is going up. What about on the production side? Well, there's some scary things there. I'm not going to talk about climate change because that was the session beforehand, but climate change is really concerning. Water scarcity. The competition for water throughout the world is getting more and more complex. Competition for water underlines some of the issues that Brian and his organisation are dealing with on a day-to-day basis. The bright colours there is where there is water scarcity and competition for water. And you can see how many of them overlap with some of the most politically unstable parts of the world. Soil degradation. Again, we are not investing in our soils as much as we should do. A complex issue because soils have elements of both being a private good and a public good. But there is a concern that we're undermining our capacity to produce food in the future. So that's a brief canter through of some of the problems ahead. I hope I've avoided what a colleague refers to in some of these talks as the pornography of gloom, where you just spend the whole time talking about the challenges. But there are real challenges ahead. And then just to summarise some things, continuing demand growth, urbanisation and megacities. I suspect most people in this audience know the huge transition that has taken place over the last few decades, with now over half the global population living in cities. I suspect that has not permeated through the policy landscape as much as it should do. And again, I'm going to come back to that a bit at the end. Hunger and undernutrition. I think we have to remember the good news around hunger. So the Millennium Development Goal on hunger, I think, was the only one of the Millennium Development Goals that that has been met. But there are still a large number of people who go to bed hungry at night, and many of them is our fault. They are not due to the ability to feed them, it's because of where they live. Undernutrition is still a far greater problem. India, which has essentially got rid of calorie hunger, is still struggling with undernutrition. And then obesity and overnutrition, this issue that just no one knew about 20 or 30 years ago, at least there's a real public health hazard, has just come up and hit us. That is going to be an increasing part of the dialogue and the policy discussion around food going into the future. And then just to summarise some of the other things I said, pressures on agriculture, water scarcity, competition for land and soil, and then resilience to shocks, and again, climate change shocks, but also our inability to have, and this again goes back to some of the discussion that we were having about the falling back from globalization, our ability to act collectively to try and reduce some shocks. Okay, so as I said, that's a canter through some of the challenges. In the second part of the talk, I'm going to describe a little bit some of the research that we are doing at Oxford. I'm going to do this at a very high level. What we do is we set up a modelling framework that allows us to ask questions of the food system in the future. And today, just because I'm only speaking for half an hour, I'm going to ask the question, what if we eat healthily? And I'm going to say what I mean by that. But just briefly, some of the other things that we explore is how will climate change affect diet-related deaths? We can do experiments where we can explore different fiscal regimes. What if we taxed climate unfriendly food, again going back to some of the themes before the breaks. And then some of you will be familiar with the conceptualization of some of the environmental problems going ahead. through planetary boundaries, which has both positive and negative aspects to it. We've done quite a bit of work which fed into the recent Lancet Commission report on how we can feed the world within planetary boundaries. So do contact me if you'd like to know what we've been doing on that. But as I said, the question I'm going to ask today is, what if we eat healthily? I'm going to say virtually nothing about the what's under the hood, what's under the bonnet of this, beyond to say that we have a collection of models that talk to each other. And we do some of this work with the International Food Policy Research Institute in Washington, who have a neat, again, if there are economists in the audience, a partial equilibrium model of the food system. So this is a model that allows you to put changes through the food system and see how prices and demand and supply adjust. And we've linked that model to health health modules and to environment modules. So we can do these sort of thought experiments with the food system going ahead and seeing what consequences a policy decision will have, or a new driver will have, on both environmental and health outcomes. The most important thing to say is that the people who actually do this work, and the chap Marco Springman to the left there, these are the people, the young postdocs on the project, they're the ones who actually do it, rather than the superannuated professors like me who get up and talk about it. So it's very important to give them the credit for it. So what if we eat healthily? So the question we do here is, we say, well, what happens if the world transitions to consuming the diet that the World Health Organization recommends by 2050? And so this is a diet which has less meat in it, has more fruit and vegetables in it, and is in accord with the best nutritional advice today. And I'm just going to show the results from that. We've also looked at various other options, such as Mediterranean diets and vegetarian diets. We try and do this in a fairly sophisticated way, so we don't assume that the whole world will be eating exactly the same thing. A WHO recommended diet in, for example, China is going to be different from Europe, is going to be different from Peru. And so we try and transition to these recommended diets, taking into account what's happening locally, and then feeding back to both the environmental consequences and also the health consequences. And we've done a little bit on economics that I will touch on, but not very much. And I guess what I urge you to do is to not believe any of the results I'm about to show you. These are not predictions. They are a means of testing one's intuitions. They're a means of testing one's projections into the future. I do think that's a really important point. If you're trying to explore these scenarios into the future, you cannot do it verbally. The English or any other language is just incapable of doing it. You have to do it quantitatively. But certainly when I talk to policymakers, there can be a risk that you show a policymaker a graph or especially a map. It looks so seductive that they can assume it's a prediction. It's not. It's a means of increasing your understanding. So I'm going to show you a few maps, and sort of working in the UK at the moment, we went to the Foreign Office to ask, well, what map should be using? And they gave us this map. It was when Boris Johnson was at the Foreign Office. And we did notice the position of the UK is in a rather odd position there. So we weren't completely happy with this, and we moved it back to what we think might be the right thing. So remember what we're doing here is we're doing, in a sense, a quantitative thought experiment. So what we have done is we have said, well, what's going to happen if we eat healthily? And the result we get is that you have 5 million avoided deaths per year. Now, we're all going to die from something, but these are deaths associated with poor diets. Now, what does actually 5 million mean? Now, I'm going to put that in context in a way that I hope you don't think is respectful. Disrespectful for the people involved. The other sort of area I'm really interested in is the epidemiology of malaria. Malaria is the worst infectious disease. It kills round about 500,000 people a year, actually largely children in Africa. So we're talking about 10 times the benefit of moving to healthy diets is of the order of 10 times more deaths avoided than curing the worst infectious disease. Now, again, many of you will have spotted, well, it's a little bit different because the deaths due to diets tend to be older and the deaths due to malaria younger. But I hope that gives sort of a little bit of context. There is a really major advantage for doing that. Now, something that really surprised me is actually most of the avoided deaths are not in the poorest parts of the world, they're in some of the richest parts of the world. The darker green colours there are where you get more avoided deaths. And actually a lot of them are in developed countries, and that's because our diets are so bad. And a lot of it actually is, it's as basic as eating your five a day. So transitioning to a WHO diet gives you this real health benefit. And here are the carbon dioxide benefits. We're looking at a suite of environmental consequences, but the only one we've really done properly at a global level is greenhouse gas emissions. Now, at the moment, business as usual, we expect the emissions from the food system to go up by 50% by the middle of the century. If we've moved to eating healthily, then that 50% rise turns into a 7% rise. Now, actually, we have to do far better than that. We have to, and again, as earlier speaker said, we have to reduce emissions really substantially. But this is just diet change. Of all the many other things that could happen, you go from 51% increase to getting towards no increase just by diet change. And that's before you do all the other adaptation and mitigation. The green colours are where you get most benefits in terms of reduced emission. The yellow colours is where emissions will go up. And I think this is an important point that will not be lost on anyone here. We in the rich world cannot lecture people who are way before us in the development trajectory. We need to do better in the rich world in order to allow people in the poor world to produce the amount of greenhouse gases that they need to in order for their diets and their way of life to catch up with us. Of course, there are opportunities for leapfrogging technology and things, but again, we have to be very careful in the message that we put across there. And finally, so the argument there is that by changing diets, we both have substantial health and environmental co-benefits. And our preliminary work on water and biodiversity shows those environmental co-benefits are in multiple dimensions. What about economics? Now, here we really are sort of flying by the seat of our pants, especially on the right-hand graph. But if you just sort of use a metric of the advantage of taking carbon out of the atmosphere, the social cost of carbon, and then if you look at the health benefits in terms directly of reductions of costs to the health system and indirect costs due to lost time at work, then one is getting benefits in terms of US trillions of getting up to 1 trillion. And again, just to sort of frame what these numbers mean, the sort of total GDP of the world is 80 trillion. So one is getting, you know, one is up there in as much as one believes these figures of really quite significant economic co-benefits as well. Now, environmental economists and other economists do questions where they try and say, well, how much would you pay? What is the utility of an extra few years of life due to a better diet? And they try and come up with, they're sometimes called hedonic measures of this. And when you do that, and this is really where put multiple small print health warnings on these figures, you come up with advantages of the order of 10% of gross world GDP. So the benefit there. Now, you can do that in many different ways, and other economists don't like this approach. But I think the basic message here is that there are substantial economic, health, and environmental reasons for changing diets. And why wouldn't we? Well, there's an interesting question there. Of course, there are issues about personal choice and things, but there is a real reticence on behalf of governments in particular to get involved with this, the narrative around the nanny state and things. Okay, so in the last 5 minutes, I want to talk about one particular midterm food security challenge that hopefully will make a link a bridge between my talk and Brian's talk next. And I subtitled this, so people say, well, what keeps you awake at night about thinking about the food system? And I worry about these medium to long term things, but here's something that keeps me awake at night about in the shorter term. And let me frame this just by putting up a couple of statistics. And this is the percentage income spent on food and alcohol for a collection of countries that were chosen by the USDA. So I don't quite know what the why they chose this one. But if you take countries near the top, Cameroon, a representative sub-Saharan African country, Belarus, Egypt, Kenya, the top four, followed by Pakistan. An average citizen in those countries is spending 50% of their income on food. Now, we have just forgotten, I think, what that means. Really, if you go back 100 years in the United States and Europe, that was similar to us. But look right down at the bottom, UK and USA. In the USA, probably 8% of average income goes on food. Probably at no time since money was invented has such a small fraction of the income being spent on food. I keep meaning to remove the alcohol from this graph, because when I show it to my students, they just look at the alcohol. They're amazed and cheer that we in the UK drink more than the French do, you know. We always thought it was the reverse. And then they look at Hungary, and sort of all the questions I get is, why is that? Surely they should be called thirsty, not hungry. So I will at some stage remove the alcohol. So anyway, the point there is that in low-income countries, you spend much more of your disposable income, your income rather, on food. This refers to something I said earlier on. More than 50% of the world's population now lives in cities. By the middle of the century, it's going to be 2/3 of the world population living in cities. Here are where the major cities are, with hot colours showing where they're growing. So look across Southern Asia, and you can see vast numbers of big cities growing. But the really hottest cities in terms of growing are in sub-Saharan Africa. So the squares are cities over 10 million. Kinshasa, Cairo's 11 million. It'll be 22 million predicted by 2050. So that's there's not a lot of agricultural land in Cairo. Look in Mali and Burkina Faso. So Bamako and Ouaga. These are cities really, really growing. So that's the second point I'd make. Now, the last point I'd make is, let's put all developing countries together. So these are low and low middle income countries, and look at their cereal trade. So those are the exporting nations, and those are the importing nations, with the green line there being net imports. So developing countries at the moment are exporting vast amounts of grain from international commodity markets. And in many ways, this makes economic sense. In economic sense, you look at countries which have a comparative advantage. And the countries which have a grain surplus, for example, many in South America, are shifting a large amount of grain to some of the poorest countries. And it is this grain transfers that means that Kinshasa, Ouaga, Bamako, all those other big countries are not starving at the moment. Now, it is devoutly to be hoped that there is going to be investment, institutional change, and a greater capacity for those countries to produce food in the future. And this is beginning to happen. But for the foreseeable future, the meeting the food demands of these countries is going to depend on a well-functioning global commodity system. Now, some, I think, very well-meaning people in talking about the food system hate the fact that food is a global commodity, hate the fact that the food system is globalized. And I would say that is dangerously misconceived. Without a globalized food system, we would have far more problems than we do at the moment. And I think Joseph Stiglitz, the economist, put it very succinctly and said, we have globalization, it's a fact, get over it. The real challenge is making, The real challenge is making globalization work, especially for the poorest of the world. And let me just go back to the FAO Food Price Index. This isn't quite brought up to date, but that's just sort of looking at it. And look at the bits there which where there were the food price hikes. Now, I hope I'm not trespassing on Brian's next topic, but during those during those two periods of food price hikes, one had civil unrest, riots, in some cases even changes of governments, in many, many places in the developing world. So this is my worry. We have a globalized food system, which is good, and it's a food system that is largely run by private sector companies, which I have no problems with in principle, and actually largely a relatively small number of countries, of companies. I would sleep better at night if I knew that that food system had been stress tested. Throw yourself back, imagine you were a banker in the early 2000s, the noughties. You would wish that the banks had stress tested the system, their system, prior to 2008. One had all the, in my world's parlance, all the network effects that caused the financial contagion and the crash of 2008. I worry about the same things happening in the food system, and I would like to, and it may be fine, I don't know, and again, this isn't a potential criticism of the private sector, but I would like to know. Because if we get it wrong, if we get major starvation in sub-Saharan Africa, not only will it overwhelm organisations such as the World Food Programme that we'll hear about shortly, but I worry about the extent of migration, the tragedies that we've seen played out in the news reports on our television screens over the last couple of years will be as nothing to what we would get if we got that wrong. So, just to conclude, and forgive me for going over a minute or so, I think the food system is entering uncharted waters. What we need to do, our response is both complex and simple. It's complex because there are many things that have to be done. It's simple because we need actions on all fronts. Change diets, produce more food with less effects on the environment, reduce waste, attend to governance. And just on that last point, I do think we need to stress test more formally the global food system. And then, I suspect something I don't need to say for this audience, but whatever you care about, I'm a biologist, my background is biodiversity, I care desperately about biodiversity. You will care about other things. But whatever you care about, food is so so fundamental that if we fail on food, we fail on everything. Thank you very much indeed.